hello everyone, and welcome to episode 125 of the Grand Prix Show for coverage of the season finale Brazilian Grand Prix from Sao Paulo, Brazil. Something like that. I'm Robin Warner.
And I am Jim Lau. Put a fork in the 2012 F1 season because it is done, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
We have reached the finale. It's been quite a journey getting here. This is a big change. That just 1 week ago, we were at the race in Austin, and to be back at Formula One show headquarters. Sorry, whoa, don't say those words.
Yes.
Fun with Cars Grand Prix show
that
headquarters.
That sounds better, yes.
With our usual streams of information coming in on computers, especially during a rainy race, it's very nice to be in our nice, comfortable living room and watching the race on a big screen with Twitter and Facebook and all of our friends at our side. So as I posted online, I think the timing of the Brazilian race is about optimal for me in terms of time of day.
Yeah.
So it came on at 11 a.m. here in Michigan. And so right now Brazil is 3 hours away from us. And it was really about right, because if it comes on in the afternoon, it sort of takes up the whole day. So it was watch the race and then go get lunch. And then now here we are after that to podcast and whatever. This works great for me. And it's great for Western Europe because it's anywhere from like sort of 4 to 7 p.m. Aussies, though, really kind of get the short end of the stick on this one.
I think it started
between midnight and 3 a.m. in Australia. And went on from there. So a couple of our friends down under were having the sun come up as they were finishing the race and trying to either go to bed or go off to work or school or whatever. So
right.
But for us here in the Western Hemisphere, I'm all about it.
Another sufferer made me think, Colin Sato. Hawaii time probably isn't great.
Yeah,
on this one.
He's in Hawaii, so you know
that's true.
You can't feel too bad for the guy.
That's very true. Well put.
Yeah.
It was, to say the least, an exciting race. And I have to say, though, from a personal standpoint, it was also quite fascinating to go from the being physically in the stands watching it live, not having a strong idea of what's going on, to the watching it live from your couch and being totally immersed with three laptops and the television involved and Twitter and Facebook and then the F1 show feed, the Formula One feed, coming up. So to just have that that difference between the two events was fascinating to me, because it's like there's too much information and I'm trying to process it all, and Jim's computer brain wasn't having any problems, of course. But to the actual race itself, it was fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes we'll sort of try to summarize, the main points, this guy started out and then this guy passed and whatever, and sort of like, and that was kind of the race starting off point. But if somehow you have not seen this race, or at least, I don't know, followed a sort of a play-by-play article or something, watched a synopsis of it, you really have to. I mean, we can't do it justice for all the little movings and shakings that happened throughout this race. It was right from the word go, right off the start through turn one, lap one. I mean, just the whole thing was drama-filled. We had a Vettel spin. Was that lap one? I think it was.
It was lap one or two. I wanted to look that
up. At the very beginning, we had Vettel turned around with the whole field streaming past him. And then, of course,
damage.
Yeah, and damage on the car. But then it seemed okay. And then we had retirement from a crash of the first two guys. I mean, all kinds of craziness. A legitimate on-track pass for the lead by a Force India, of all things. I mean, it was... lots and lots going on, and we can't hope to sort of fill you in. If you didn't see it, you really just kind of need to follow the race. But where we will come in is sort of the commentary and our thoughts and our takes on the whole thing. And I guess, I mean, we'll start. There is an obvious elephant in the room, or a rouge bovine in the room, but I don't want to shortchange Jenson Button on a really very solid drive today and with him coming home with the win.
Yeah, Jenson Button qualified second. He was on the front row right next to Lewis Hamilton. He was very close to him in qualifying pace. They were passing each other for the lead in the early laps. And Jenson Button, once again, made a great strategic call, or had luck, either way you want to look at it, and stayed on the dry tires when Hamilton went on to the intermediates early on. And Jenson's call turned out to be the right one, and him and Nico Hülkenberg ended up being 44 seconds clear of the field before we had that first safety car. And then a couple of things happened here and there, which we will get to. And Jenson Button was able to take this chaotic race and stay in front and take a win from it, which makes him, he's been given the nickname by me, Jensen Bookend Button, because he won the very first race of the season. Now he's won this one.
Good old bookend.
Exactly. And he it's the difficult races that he tends to win. And this was just another example. And one of the things I tweeted, which felt weird to tweet, but I'm working on, I'm trying to improve that. I learned what a hashtag was today, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, and, Robin is upping his Twitter game in a major way.
And is that Jensen Button is introducing himself to the team as the new team leader in a most, you know, triumphant way. And this is a great way to do it. Although, of course, it came off the heels of Lewis Hamilton, you know, getting taken out of the race. But we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, so, I mean, we were talking, there was sort of a rundown of champions, of recent world champions and driver champions and whatever, and they sort of barely mentioned Jensen Button, you know, in terms of, you know, all the drama that there's been with, you know, from Schumacher to Alonso's little dynasty there, and then the rise of Vettel and the whole, you know, the Kimi one-off and Lewis one-off, and they're like, oh, by the way, 1 year Jensen also won it, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, it's for a solid drive, and like you say, when it really sort of seems to be difficult in these wet but drying and sort of, you know, with the combination of Jensen and his engineer and the team around him to make the right strategy calls, but also to be able to drive whatever he's got on the car at the time and you know, be smart about it. He really does seem to do well in these really weird conditions, wet but drying. You know, I remember his first win in Hungary that way. You think of his win in Canada, you know, his various, you know, just taking advantage of the situation, being able to stay out on this rubber. And we saw a lot of really good drivers. I mean, they're all really good drivers, but, you know, a lot of people getting it slightly wrong, some more costly than others in the race. But, yeah, I mean, it ended up, we had Lewis Hamilton, who was in the lead of the race for a while, was, you know, eventually taken out by Nico Hülkenberg. In what Nico Hülkenberg was penalized for as avoidable contact, but we don't really agree with that call.
We do not.
But, I mean, Hamilton was doing a great job as well, and it was, you know, sort of not, I would say not his fault. I mean, I don't think you can put Hamilton at blame for this, but did end up getting collected, and somehow, you know, Jensen was just able to, you know, be where he needed to be and away from the drama just well enough to hold on to it and, you know, at least have a McLaren stamp on the last race of the season. And as that stood, you know, that meant that Alonso second and Massa third, which, of course, they wouldn't finish the race in any other order but Alonso ahead of Massa, being Ferrari as they are. But, yeah, which at the end of the day, of course, handed the championship to Sebastian Vettel. Not handed to, but Vettel won the championship. You could say, you could debate how it was earned or given or locked into or whatever, but at the end of the day, Sebastian Vettel is a three-time back-to-back-to-back world champion, and Alonso is not. And, you know, the with a McLaren victory at the end of it, and Ferrari's filling out the podium. So just kind of a jumbled day.
I mean, there's a whole lot of interesting things you can take from that, right? You know, who earned it more? You know, Alonso, certainly he had two races where, you know, he was taken out right at the beginning that really weren't his fault. Spa, the clear and obvious one, but also let's not forget Japan. And those were two races where he could have scored, you know, easily scored another set of valuable points and would have made this championship very different. Of course, Vettel's alternator failure in, I believe it was Valencia, that certainly didn't help him out. And then there's a whole side of just what happened at McLaren. They seemed to be, if you were to aggregate the whole season, they probably had the fastest car. Yet they finished third in the Constructors' Championship and fourth and fifth in the Drivers' Championship. So there's all kinds of things that happen that are just kind of sum up in this weird way in Brazil, you know, where McLaren wins the race, but Red Bull wins the Constructors and the Drivers, and yet Ferrari, who had this terrible car at the beginning of the season, somehow ends up second in the Constructors' Championship and second in the Drivers' Championship.
And second and third on the podium, yeah. It's really kind of a weird mix, and, you know, the overall end, it was a weird of sort of finale where the absolute end of the race was under the safety car, so it all kind of tapered off rather than this dramatic, you know, cross the line, checkered flag kind of moment. It did kind of fizzle off at the very end of it. But, I mean, this race, the title of saying something is the best race is a bit sort of oversimplifying it.
It's
right?
Loaded. It's a loaded way to say it, too.
So many things that are good and bad. I mean, a lot of people really, really like the USGP, and, of course, we did as well. But I mean, this really was just a really good time. I mean, we had, it's like you couldn't script this stuff if you wanted to, and
unless Bernie Ecclestone did, in which case, good job.
Yeah, in which case, well played, sir. Because, yeah, I mean, it was these, there were moments where as they ran, Alonso would win it. As they ran, Vettel would win it.
Absolutely.
Of course, India was leading for a while. What if Hülkenberg is the ninth winner this year and different driver to win?
And I believe it would have been the seventh different constructor
right,
to win.
And the first win
like
for Force India. I mean, that was a real possibility for a time. You know, we had, unfortunately, Senna taken out in the very, very beginning, which, of course, is home fans and all that. But then the Brazilians still have Massa to cheer for. But then ultimately, they want Alonso to win because he's the team. You know, it's like so many dynamics that were just really kind of just fun to watch them play out. And to see it all happen and also to not be, you know, being rained on at the time was nice.
Right. Well, you mentioned Senna being taken out. That did happen on the first lap, I'm pretty certain. I just looked that up. And he was taken out by a young Sebastian Vettel. And there was, among the Twitter sphere and other places, some controversy about whether that incident is much different than what happened to Grosjean at the beginning of Spa. And why wasn't Vettel much less banned for a race, but not even penalized at all for that event, when even just later on, Hülkenberg was indeed penalized for causing a preventable incident. So I think I still firmly believe that Grosjean shouldn't have been banned for that accident, and that, you know, if you wanted to say it was his fault for preventable, absolutely, that's now the past. But if you look at those two incidents, Hülkenberg v. Hamilton, then Vettel v. Senna, it seems like, if anything, Vettel's incident was more preventable, you know, more of a risk, so on and so forth, and he didn't get anything. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, I because we're watching this live, I didn't have a whole lot of chance to go through replays. I haven't sort of seen that one from all the angles I would want to before really saying, you know, this really assigning all the blame to Vettel. I mean, I guess you could say, yeah, Vettel turned in on Senna, or that, you know, Senna happened to be there, you know, in the middle of the track when he could have been tighter in the line or whatever. So I don't quite have the analysis that I would need to really put assign the blame on it. But yeah, I mean, the question was, of course, you know, I don't think anyone says that Grosjean was deliberately, you know, slamming Hamilton off the track, you know, crashing into anybody. It was just, was the move that he made too much, too optimistic or too risky, or should he have been cooler about it? And to that point, I guess you could sort of say, well, Vettel has proven himself able to pull off these moves in a way that maybe Grosjean hasn't. So, you know, you can't be, you know, it's not so over-optimistic. Vettel can afford to be optimistic because, you know, in the past he's shown, obviously he's already double world champion on his way to being third, that it's not, you know, unbelievable that he would be able to make this kind of crazy pass, where maybe it is a bit more unbelievable for Grosjean, who is much less of a proven entity, to be able to push that hard and so on. So there's a couple different dynamics when you sort of look at how preventable was it or how risky was it. There's several kind of judgment calls you have to make in there, that it's not just what were the facts, what was the steering angle, where was he on track. There is sort of this expectation of experience and you know, predicted outcome, and how close was the predicted outcome to whatever. So I don't know that you can
and that's
how
all
comparable they are, I guess.
That's all fair, but and I certainly see that side, but at the same time, once you take that point of view, then it does seem like you are expecting the FIA stewards to have their biases and use the bias to make judgments that affect the outcome of the race. And should they have that, or should they work hard to look at things on a case-by-case basis, wipe away the fact that one driver has one status and another driver has another, and say, in this specific incident, these two drivers have had an accident. Driver A was at fault, or driver B was at fault, or it was a racing incident. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, there's, I think at some point you can't.
You can't fully do that, but do you at least want to try to do that as opposed to just going the other way?
It's kind of a good question. But I guess since you can't, it's, you know, I guess there are big picture, of course. I mean, ultimately, you know, Formula One, it's a sport and it's entertainment and it's a marketing thing. So there's lots of things. I mean, if they had decided, okay, Vettel, I mean, I guess a race ban at the end of the season is a little bit weird. Just would they ban him at the beginning of the next season?
That would have been overly aggressive anyway. That was.
But so then if you can't do that, then it's, you know, they may have had this conversation of practical concern of like, okay, well, what would it be? Would a drive-through penalty be appropriate? You know, it's like, oh, well, he got a race suspension and this is just a drive-through penalty, or would a stop and go? And if they said, okay, well, Vettel would have won the championship if it weren't for the stop-and-go penalty, but the stop-and-go was kind of unprecedented. Like, at some point, you know, there is the what is the ideal that we go for, and then there's what is the practical, you know, in this instance, with the data we have in front of us, you know, what call do we make?
Right.
And, you know, right. It's there's no clear answer, I don't think, but it's interesting to kind of, I guess, to kind of contemplate what how that could have gone. But I guess what I am glad to see, and something we talked about at the time, is that there was no post-race demotion or
Absolutely.
Post-race penalty, because
Absolutely.
That, of all the different outcomes, you know, we've had podiums change, winners change after the podium, but to have a world champion change after the fact, if it said, oh, wait, actually, we reviewed this data more closely, or so we had a complaint from so-and-so, and now we just remember, oh, we had 20 seconds of Vettel's time, and he's no longer champion, actually, it's Alonso, after all the emotion and all
oh,
the podium
man.
And everything that
Can
had gone
you imagine?
On. That would have been ridiculous and terrible, and they know that. Even if that,
right.
they look at something and they say, you know what, the most fair thing to do would be to punish Vettel, but in the interest of
right.
credibility and blah 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 blah, all the commercial deal, all the nonsense of, you know, how much news would that make? You know, one thing is to say, okay, Vettel is world champion, the Formula One season is over. You know, that's going to, you know, come up on your Speed Center and your sort of, you know, Motorsports Roundup and news stuff. But to say, you know, the story is very different if it's like, look at this, they crowned this guy champion, but then 20 minutes later, they made this guy champion.
Right.
I mean, that's looking at it a whole other way. And, you know, the stewards and everybody are, at some level, FOM has to be cognizant of that. And it's not easy, because it's sort of, in a way demeaning to sort of just to think down to think of F1 as, well, it's kind of this big marketing thing at the end of the day. You know,
but
you like to think it's more than that.
All
but
sports are, and that is, no, it's a very practical, reasonable way that you have to look at it, as much as you may not want to. But what troubles me a little bit, because I agree with all that, I really do, but then, you know, if you're going to have that attitude, I really feel like, if you're going to look at the two penalties that happened, the two possible incidents that happened during the day, the two big ones, Hulkenberg v. Hamilton, how is that not a racing incident if the Vettel Senna one is a racing incident? That one really, really makes it hard for me to swallow, because to me, Hulkenberg and Hamilton, that was great racing. And what Vettel did to Senna was a little bit of a punk move, but you're kind of saying, okay, there's all these things going on. There's a lot of reasons that are legitimate to let him get away with that. But then penalize Hulkenberg the way they did really just did not sit well with me.
Yeah, I can't say I agree with the Hulkenberg penalty. There's two ways you could look at that, though. So it was what happened is, on a downshift, Hulkenberg's car just, you know, the rear end locked up, which I guess goes right back to our conversation about differentials and, you know, corner entry.
Yep.
How much did it decide to – did the differential try to keep the rear wheels going the same speed, and how does that link with the engine? Is that it, you know, under that downshift, I think it was for turn one, the rear of the car just kind of stepped out on him, and it came around, and Hamilton's car was right there, and it spun him out. So it wasn't like an overly like late braking maneuver to try to dive down the inside of a corner
Not
and push him
all.
Out. It
Not
wasn't some, you know, from way back in the field trying to do something weird. It was that, you know, he, you know, had the, it's not that he missed a shift even, it doesn't seem like, it was just that, you know, under downshifting, he just lost control
the
of the
rear
car.
End got away from him.
So there's two things you could say. I mean, one is, okay, is that, how would he have known that that was going to happen? And if he did know that that was going to happen, he shouldn't have been there. Well, we did see, I mean, that's how Hulkenberg lost the lead, was that had happened a couple of laps prior, that he was out in the lead, did the downshift, that actually kind of did a half spin, and Button was able to get through and, you know, get out in the lead. And then that's what put him back fighting with Hamilton. And so in one side, you could say, okay, well, Hulkenberg, having seen that two laps ago, should know, okay, this may happen to my car. He should be a, you know, aware enough driver to know, when I do this, the car does that, and sort of understand that, okay, under these downshifts, the car gets unstable, so I need to be extra careful, which may have been where the conversation ended up. But the other thing is, it's like, there was no, first of all, there's nothing to gain from Hulkenberg doing that. I mean, I guess ultimately he took out his rival, but there's no way for him to know. I mean, I don't think there's any way you can look at the data and read that as an intentional calculation on Nico's part to say, I'm going to do this, the car's going to step around, my car's going to be fine, so I'm going to go on with my race, but I'm going to knock out
absolutely
Hamilton.
Not.
There's just no way. And it wouldn't have made sense for him to do so anyway. I mean, you'd have to look at it very differently if Vettel were to crash into Alonso in, you know, such a way that ended both of their races, and all of a sudden, look, that means Vettel's champion. That's something you have to really analyze. Okay, is there any possible way this could be a sort of a planned thing or opportunity, whatever? But what we have with Hulkenberg is just not that. So I agree that doesn't strike me as a penalizable if we can go there, event.
I'll run with that.
We'll allow it. Cool. As an event worthy of a penalty, in my opinion, based on kind of what we just ran through.
Absolutely. So to go back to the accident with Senna and Vettel, it's one of those things where almost no matter what happened, they were stuck between a rock and a hard place, were the FIA stewards, because by not penalizing them, we're having this discussion. If they had indeed penalized Vettel, then that would have caused another discussion.
Right.
You know, it would have been the Formula One, what is FIA,
Ferrari. International Assistance.
International Assistance, yeah. Exactly. So it could definitely be taken both ways. So they were in a tough position. My personal opinion, though, having said that, is they went the wrong way with some of those things. I think there was a little bit too much bias and concern about the circumstances as opposed to the actual facts of what happened in each isolated incidents. And it's a difficult balance. I do not envy their position and fully respect it. And I certainly completely want to second what you said, is it's done. It's over. There's no point in dwelling over it. We should move on. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think they got the call wrong. Now, there's the second thing that was under scrutiny of what Vettel did. Vettel's pass under yellow, and I'm doing air quotes here, of Kobayashi. Based on everything we've seen, that wasn't actually the case. And Vettel really didn't do anything wrong. It was circumstantial, and it was reviewed 100 times over, and it was deemed that what Vettel did was actually legitimate.
Yeah, and the only thing that was weird about that is there was a debris flag, and here flag means light being flown / illuminated.
Right.
And the difference is, yeah, yellows are blinking, rapidly blinking. Yellow flag is, or yellow light is indicating of a yellow flag, and this was just a debris flag, which is apparently not flashing, although it kind of looked like it was from the onboard camera. So it looked, you know, from the in-car camera, looked at first glance, or sort of, you know, first run through at full speed when there's everything else going on in the race that there is, like, wait, he'd made that pass, but hold on, he's going by this corner and there's this yellow thing lit up. You know, it sort of struck a lot of people on first viewing as like, wait, was that a yellow flag? But yeah, after being reviewed, it was, you know, there wasn't a yellow flag in that corner. It was just sort of some, you know, if anything, a bit of a vague flag where it's a yellow and red is indicating debris rather than a blinking yellow indicating a local yellow for caution. So, yeah, just kind of a sort of, you know, I don't think anyone watching it on TV can be faulted for kind of like second looking that and go, wait a minute, wasn't that a yellow flag?
Yeah, right.
But
absolutely.
At the same time, there's not really a controversy there. But it was a little bit of you know, miscommunication slight misread of people watching at home. But no worries, that's not really a scandal or anything there.
I don't
think that was actually supposed to be a yellow flag, and it just ended being a yellow flag. And what I think is interesting, we've come up across before, is like kind of exactly where a yellow flag period starts and ends. You know, it's supposed to be within view of the yellow flag, but I guess depending on where you are on the track and how the corners of the track are laid out, you know, where you can see the flag or see the light is, you know, maybe a little bit under that can be very different and just different enough to matter, you know. So that's where the real sort of yellow flag controversy may come up, and it hasn't, thankfully, in a while. But if there's a pass that happens and sort of, you know, is it if you complete the pass right before you can see the yellow flag, or
right,
if you're alongside and one guy's wheel's in front of another, and then as you come around this corner, all of a sudden there's a flag, then do you have to back off? Or is the other guy back off? You know, that's more of the, if there is any yellow flag kind of controversy or scandal, I think it would be in that area. But what we saw today was just simply, it kind of looked like a yellow flag, but it wasn't. So
right,
no worries. And thankfully that means, again, we don't have to go back after the race and do a penalty that changes the whole results of the championship.
Right. And, you know, it's understandable. Again, we're not taking light of the fact that there's a lot at stake here in terms of notoriety, in terms of history, and just in terms of strict finances. You know, the winner makes, you know, $100 million plus as a constructor, and the driver champion makes millions of dollars. I mean, there's lots of money at stake, which is important to the teams and important to the performance of 2013. So we get that, you know what I mean? There's no misunderstanding there, but at the same time, you don't want to create drama. You look at it closely, and if the facts bear out that that's what it is, then let's be done with it. Let's not make controversies and kind of you know, make stories out of nothing.
Yeah. So where there is a story, though, I think is just Fernando Alonso. I mean, you could say, you know, what he did today, which is almost sort of a corollary to what he did for the whole season. I feel like a lot of people, even, you know, traditionally McLaren fans and, you know, not really probably Red Bull fans, but a lot of people in sort of the people like us that aren't really behind one particular guy, but just kind of interested in the sport as a whole and kind of what's cool about it and all that, we're really rooting for Alonso to just as improbable as it is with the way the car has been and the way just everything has happened, that we're really rooting for Alonso to win the championship. And I feel like, you know, today he did everything he possibly could. He ended up coming second, you know, not he was, you know, well behind Button at the very end. Well, I guess at the very end he was behind the safety car, but, you know.
Right.
But
it was like 20-second gap before the safety car.
Worked his way up. Obviously, Massa let him around because he's Massa and that's Ferrari and that's what the deal is. But,
yep.
But just that, you know, this is kind of where we get into kind of who earned it or whatever. But I guess, you know, the idea is, in my opinion anyway, it's sort of, you know, Alonso had a harder task to accomplish what he accomplished because he wasn't in the best car. And it was not that, not to take away that, you know, say what Vettel did was easy, because obviously Vettel is a very, very, very skilled driver, and it takes more than a good car to you know, be first in the championship.
All you got
to
do is look at Mark Webber, who's a very good driver in his own right.
Right. And it just takes, you know, that extra something special. And then you look at Massa as a comparison for Alonso in the same car, and to see Alonso do as well as he has and outperform Massa as much as he has, it's like, really, just Alonso, just, you know, it's like driving with this, like, level of heart that you just don't always see, which is funny because, of course, he was, you know, such the villain a couple of years ago of sort of, you know, this evil-looking dude and just kind of, yeah, the whole
Well,
situation.
I mean, he was tied up in the major controversy of McLaren in 2007 that turned into that massive scandal that cost McLaren its Constructors' Championship, period.
Yeah.
They were kicked out of it and $100 million. And then in 2008, he was involved. Not officially, but I'm still skeptic that he had, you know, he played more than zero of a part in the Singapore Grand Prix. Him winning that race after Nelson Piquet Jr. deliberately crashed the car.
Right.
So there's that, and then there's Fernando being faster than Felipe Massa at the Hungarian Grand Prix in 2010. I mean, it's just all these things that just add to his like heartless, win at all costs kind of nature, which is easy to villainize, but. In the last couple of years, that hasn't happened, and what has been able to come out as a result is just how fantastic of a driver Alonso is, and how consistently good he is.
Right. I mean, to look at the stats and to see no like mechanical retirements or, you know, crashes really for Alonso. I mean,
that are Alonso's fault.
Right. You know, no sort of, you know, should we penalize Alonso for this or not? Like, it's just, he's just done his thing. He's had, you know, and I guess the fact that he's not in this runaway victorious car. And to sort of, you know, manhandle that Ferrari as best he can to get the results he can out of it has been what's so cool, and to sort of see him earn it that way. And then also, you know, that he's had his two world championships, but they haven't been at Ferrari. To sort of, you know, stake his place at Ferrari,
right.
and all that. There's a lot of the kind of dynamics there. And, you know, yeah, it was really pretty wild after the race, kind of, you know, before the podium, just the look on his face, which sort of said it all. Of just kind of, you know, he did everything he possibly could have, and was, you know, going into the weekend kind of like trying to be upbeat about this, but I don't want to be unrealistic. I mean, he had a points gap. It would have, you know, he obviously outperformed Vettel in the race, but not by enough to,
right.
You know, the way that, and for a while it was looking like he was going to win it, you know, going to win the championship, and then it kind of all this back and forth, and just that final realization of there's no more, we'll try again next week, but like, nope, this one got away from him, and
right. And
he comes second, but. As we've said, you know, nobody makes a list of people that came second in the driver's championship. It's just kind of that look on his face of kind of like, you know, yeah, this, wow, that happened. That's finally, you know, I gave it everything, and this is where I came up with.
Right.
It was really, you know, kind of a touching moment, I guess.
And take a look at it from a team perspective as well. You know, Alonso had built up this massive lead in the driver's championship, and the team was giving him. There's that chunk in the second half of the mid-season where the car was just not very good. And he had, even in the performances where he didn't have these first-lap crashes, you know, he was, you know, at sometimes it seemed like, especially in qualifying, a mid-pack runner. And there's these times where they were struggling to get out of Q2 and all these types of things. You know, Ferrari did not deliver on their car. They had their hot spots, and I think the last couple of races of the seasons, the Ferrari car definitely got quicker. but it was not a consistently quick machine, and certainly not nearly as consistently quick as the Red Bull. And the other thing where I think we got to give tons of credit, I'm really just blown away, is the second half of the season, Massa's turnaround. And, you know, one of the reasons why the championship was as close as it was is because Massa gave up second place for Alonso. Massa was ahead of Alonso, legitimately.
Yeah, and he was in second place to be able to do that. Yeah.
Right. And, I mean, I think Massa has done an incredible job the second half of the season. I don't know what happened, what clicked, but, I mean, just his performance between, you know, last year was pretty bad, and then the beginning of this year was just not improving. And then to then go from there and make such a big improvement, I've been very heartened to see that, and now I'm looking forward to seeing Massa race in 2013.
So do you think that's because he has a contract for next year, and that he was, you know, maybe, you know, we've talked about sort of the, you know, can you give some more? And if the answer is yes, then what the heck have you been doing before? You know,
right.
Is it that now he's got this contract, and so he says, now I really want to, you know, show Ferrari that they made the right choice? Or wouldn't you drive harder if your job is on the line and you have to prove yourself? Or is it because he's in Brazil today, in this case today,
right,
where it's all, you know, all the Brazilian fans, you know, and the support from there? I mean,
To be totally honest, I honestly think that, so for the Brazilian case, he's always been strong in Brazil. He knows this track really well. I think he's quick here, and I think he has that extra oomph of being in front of his home crowd. So Brazil separately, I think, yes, there was some extra personal drive. But truthfully, I honestly think that Rob Smedley and Felipe Massa found something mid-season to help him improve, because his performance started improving a bit before he was guaranteed the seat for next year. And it seemed to improve even more afterwards. But I think there's a fair amount of it was just they got lucky in finally finding something to help make Massa happier in the car, honestly.
Or worked really hard to find something broke through.
Maybe it was just more and more desperate, like, look, it's really looking bad, you know. And maybe that was making it 18-hour days instead of 16-hour days or something. Maybe there was some extra push there because it was a do-or-die scenario at that point. But I honestly think that throughout all of 2011, he looked bad. He didn't want to. He never, of course not. You know, he wanted to be competitive with Alonso. And I think him and Smedley were able to start finding ways to make the car work for him better, honestly.
Yeah.
You know,
just kind of engineering, you know, moving forward and progress and whatever, not so much a magic, you know, lucky rabbit's foot.
Well, think about it. Every year you get a brand new car, and Ferrari's really been doing this. They haven't been doing evolutions of cars like Red Bull has. I mean, this car now, I think it's RB8 this year, is effectively a continuation still of the RB5. You know, the RB5 was a 2009 car, and then the RB6 was the one where it was really integrated with a W diffuser. But ever since then, it hasn't been like a clean sheet of paper for the Red Bull. They've just been continually making the tweaks that they've needed to with the rule changes and with the various things. But, you know, largely the same car. You know, Ferrari's car this year has the pull rod front suspension. It has all these new things. They just kept throwing clean sheets of paper at it. So now you have these fundamentally different chassis. Now you have to figure out the setup for this car. And maybe, and I'm just making these things up, I don't know, maybe Massa likes an oversteery car and Alonso likes an understeery car. Okay, so how do you set them up for one to be one way and the other to be other, yet still to be quick?
Yeah.
You know, and it, you know, it could have been a really tough nut to crack. Oh, and by the way, we're adding new parts to it every race. Here's a new front wing. Here's a new floor. Here's a new whatever. You know what I mean? So
yeah, it's a moving target all the way around. And everyone else is, of course, getting faster and changing exhausts and learning new things and all
and
that.
And on and on,
along
yeah.
the way.
Racing is hard.
Yeah. Well, hey, man, that's why there's only, you know, 24 guys that can do it at the top of the sharp end of the sport. So a couple other little notes we'll talk about. There was another interesting constructors battle down near the bottom of the field, though, with Caterham and Marussia. Going into this this race, Marussia was in 10th spot, which is, of course, the final points, not points, but final money-paying position in the Constructors' Championship for the TV money, and it's like $10 million or something versus 11th place where you get nothing. And so going into the weekend, they had it, and this weekend they lost that to Caterham. So, you know, Caterham now is back to 10th and finishes the season 10th place. And it's a huge, you know, more of a loss for Marussia than, I mean, it's, you know, Caterham has been that for the last 2 years. And they sort of, you know, Caterham has been the best of those three teams between them and HRT, you know, since their introduction. And especially lately with they have a Renault engine and basically a Red Bull powertrain. The curves and transmission, everything comes from Red Bull technology. So in that area of the car should be basically as good as the, you know, triple constructing world championship Red Bull team. And obviously the aerodynamics are different, and there's a lot to be said for that. And then the drivers and the budgets and the rest of the team preparation, everything around it. But that, you know, compared to the relatively out of nowhere Cosworth engine in the Marussia, and then, you know, the, I don't know what the gap in budget is back to between those teams and all that, but it was sort of a cool underdog story to see Marussia, if they were able to take over 10th place and get a big boost in terms of money, that would have been really kind of cool to see. But unfortunately, it did not pan out that way, and it was just, you know, a little bit of disappointment to see that. You know, good for Caterham, but still, this is yet another season. This is the third season that those teams have existed in which none out of those three teams have scored a single point, which is still kind of sad that that it's been that way. But
to give you a little bit of perspective on it, though, and I agree with everything you're saying, but at the same time, think about Toyota and how much trouble they had to really build a competitive car and the budget they had to do it. I mean, that is a monumental task to break into Formula One and really get in there. I agree with you, though, that I was expecting Caterham to be able to – they had that big bump in actually being in the top 10 for 2 years running, being able to get some of that FIA money for scoring in the constructors. Really thought they would start nudging a little bit closer to mid-pack running, and they weren't able to do that. So I think it's a huge credit to Marussia to be able to not have had that advantage and yet still be able to take the fight to Caterham as well they did. And I think Timo Glock and Charles Peak deserve a fair amount of that credit as well for driving really well. And Vitaly Petrov, you know, he seemed to improve a little bit towards the end of the season, you know, but Kovalainen was kind of their lead guy, and, you know, he struggled to keep up with Glock and those guys towards the end.
He may not have a job next year.
Yeah.
But so while we're on topic, just run down the driver, or the constructors championship, starting at the very bottom. So it was HRT dead last, and dead may be the word. There is, you know, they have apparently sort of laid off everyone at the factory. Everyone at that's on site for this weekend in Brazil apparently gets paid through that. But once they go back, as it stands right now, last I read and last articles and stuff I've been keeping up with, they don't have a job to go back to, and it is just kind of that's done unless there's a buyer. And the HRT PR people are saying, "Oh, we're in talks with some buyers and all that," but what else are they going to say? I mean, you know, they're not going to probably come out and say, "Well, we're dead." You know,
what USGP said before they were officially.
There's no way we won't be on the grid and blah blah blah. And,
right.
Oh wait, actually, we don't exist. So HRT. This may have been the last race ever for HRT. We'll have to see over the next couple of weeks if there is a buyer. I mean, there's been various stories swirling around about a Chinese company coming in and investing. You know, someone sort of jokingly but said, "Why don't Michael Schumacher buy that team and then just, you know, go into the sport as a team owner and, you know, as a sort of slightly goofball way to do it?" But it is kind of sad. I mean, it was Adrian Campos that, you know, sort of started that effort. And, of course, originally that team was going to be called Campos Meta F1. And that was, you know, that's the original impetus for Fernando Alonso getting into the sport and this sort of big Spanish resurgence around Alonso and all that. And then it's sort of too bad that couldn't be parlayed into some success. But HRT, you know, trying to be based in Spain, you know, move their headquarters there, which is a risky move at the time, doesn't seem to have paid off with the way it looks. And, you know, that's, you know, could be the end of the story for HRT. And it seems very likely at this point that there will be 22 cars on the grid next year and not 24. Which will change things around a little bit, but ultimately not be a huge deal. But yeah, those guys, I mean, really were in a class of their own, lower than the rest of the Formula One grid. I mean, Marussia and Caterham being as close as they are, and then everyone else on up. But HRT really was just a step back.
Yeah, honestly, the best they really managed to do was to build a car that was fast enough to comfortably stay within the 107% rule.
Yeah,
and that's really as far as it got. In terms of outright speed, they were a serious step below the Marussia and Caterham level. And, you know, we saw it very clearly in the Austin GP.
Yeah.
You know, all the other cars took off and everybody started mixing in with each other a little bit one way or the other. And then the HRTs were just you know, kind of racing each other.
And then there's the HRTs.
Right.
It's like, here goes everybody. And then... and there they go. It's like, oh, that's cute. They're still going. So anyway, the HRT, 12th spot, Marussia ahead of them, but then 10th was Caterham. So then sort of the STR, and you know, is ninth and just ahead of Caterham, and the sort of the lowest team to actually score points, at 26 points on the grid, which is a shame. I mean, we saw some double Q3 performances, you know, some top 10 qualities and some good stuff out of them throughout the year, but just overall, it was fairly common that an STR would be the odd man out in Q1, and that you know, they you know, obviously cut off both their drivers at the end of last year and got new guys, and you know, just don't have a whole lot to show for it at the very end of the season. They're behind Williams, who had, of course, one win in the season, but 76 points total, and of course, 25 of those coming from Pastor Maldonado in one race. I mean, that's, talk about a hot and cold team, and just generally cold. Force India in seventh, just ahead of them. Sauber in sixth. Mercedes in fifth.
Although I would like to see, and maybe this will be for a future podcast, and we've discussed this a little bit, if you looked at Force India's points during the last five races versus Sauber's, that'd be very fascinating to look at.
Yes.
Force India was looking quite strong.
As you say, not for this show.
Exactly.
Fifth spot is Mercedes, so with all the backing and all the Ross Brawn and Schumacher and Rosberg and the whole thing, that looking as promising as it could have been for them to come behind Lotus and McLaren and Ferrari and Red Bull is a bit of a shame. I mean, I guess, you know, they're, 20 points, not quite 20 points ahead of Sauber, but yeah, Mercedes, Lewis will have his work cut out for him next year. And of course, again, Mercedes with one win and then a lot of DNFs and a lot of reliability problems, mostly on Schumacher. But yeah, so Lotus fourth.
And Lotus fourth with more than double the points of Mercedes.
Yeah, that is, I mean, that's basically the jump right there, is that, you know, that you know, second through fourth is sort of the only place that was really close here near the end, which was, yeah, Ferrari, McLaren, Lotus. And then, you know, Red Bull, who clinched it last week, 460 points, just, you know, 60 points clear of Ferrari, just more consistently had two guys scoring points rather than one. And then McLaren, it's really a shame with two world champion drivers and with a car that was usually the fastest or could, you know, had the potential to be the fastest car. I think the story there is just, call it luck, reliability, pace of development, whatever it is, that just saw them with so many...
pit stops, for Christ's
sake. So many retirements. Just... Yeah, pit stop problems. I mean, they had the best and a lot of the worst. You know, the most retirements from the lead, all these kind of things that really were the story of the year for McLaren. But
McLaren definitely had the prettiest car. We can say that with a fair amount of confidence. And I have to say, a huge amount of credit to Lotus for what they were able to put together for 2012 here. I mean, what a great story to have, you know, Kimi Raikkonen, first year back, to be third in the Drivers' Championship. That's extremely impressive.
And with a race win, to his credit, yeah.
Absolutely. But again, that's mostly for another time.
Yeah. So, speaking of Lotus, while we're on it, we did have a funny moment with Kimi Raikkonen today, where he got off track and then started going down what looked like was sort of an access road, was actually sort of some of the old circuit. So in sort of contrast to the leave me alone, I know what I'm doing and going on to win the race.
It's like, where am I?
It's like, hold on. So people are already making jokes about that and photoshopping a picture of Kimi Raikkonen with a map in his car holding like, hold on, where am I going and all that. Not a whole lot to say about that, I guess, but that it was.
Well, we saw it real time, and I could see exactly where his logic was. Is he was trying to just find runoff and get back onto the circuit. But once you drive past an opening in the Armco, that's a bad idea.
Like, wait, hold on, this just doesn't look right. And yeah, I mean, of course, that's happened to us in, you know, video games and stuff. When you get turned around, you don't have a track map right there, and you're like, this looks right, and all of a sudden there's a barrier there. You're like, oh, this is not a part of the circuit that's really a part of the circuit.
Right.
That was a moment. That was a thing. So he ended up making his way back to the track, and it was all okay. Get back on track. Brought some mud and grass with him, but made it work. And, got on with his day. But that was sort of another funny Kimi moment, and I guess it's just part of the character of that Lotus team and of Kimi Raikkonen.
Right. And, again, it doesn't take away from the fact that they, I think, had just a tremendous season overall, and that's a season to be proud of. It didn't finish quite as strong as you might have hoped, but, you know, to be fourth in the Drivers' Championship, the Constructors' Championship, and third in the Drivers' Championship, Kimi's first year back, and Lotus, you know, been struggling to really be a top-tier team, was really quite close. So, definitely credit where credit's due there. So... we've kind of, you know, we've gone through this crazy championship, and now we're getting to this point in time where there's a whole lot of closure. You know, we are, for us Americans, we are now, we officially had the end of speed coverage of Formula One. We have one more Formula One debrief to look forward to in a week, which, you know, look forward to is kind of a qualified statement there. And next year it'll be at the network NBC Sports, which I'm assuming means that some of the races will be covered on the network NBC channel, but most will be on the cable drive sports channel.
Yeah. So NBC Sports used to be Versus, and before that it was Outdoor Life Network. So right now they've already got IndyCar has been on Versus for a while, or NBC Sports Now and whatever. And of course the big thing, the big platform for that was the Olympics this year. Was NBC brought that, and basically what their take on it is the technology and sort of what they did with live streaming and all the coverage that came through the NBC Sports Olympic app basically became the NBC Olympics app became the NBC Sports Live Extra, I think is the actual name of it. But yeah, online streaming and iPhone and iPad streaming and all kinds of different stuff. So we don't yet know exactly what that's going to look like, what the budgets will be, if they'll do anything drastically different from Speed.
Right.
I think the guess is that it won't be terribly different. I mean, they haven't announced anything official about it. I don't think if they look at, we don't know, of course, what the numbers were, what they spent on it or what the contract is worth or who pays whom and whatever the arrangements are really anyway. But I would be surprised, I guess, if we saw all of a sudden the new anchors, which we believe to be Lee Diffy and David Hobbs and Steve Matchett, so two-thirds of the or half, I guess, of the Speed team.
And Lee Diffy was also a regular sub for Bob when needed. So.
And a sports car announcer and all that. I doubt we'll see them traveling to all the races and doing, expanded coverage. I think they probably look at the way the Formula Speed has arrived at, where they have one guy that goes on site and then the rest of the guys are at a studio somewhere in the U.S. I imagine that's what we'll have again, but who knows?
Right.
If they'll even maybe for the U.S. coverage or Canadian or Brazilian coverage, on the time zones that matter or whatever, I think we'll probably have about the same arrangement in terms of Speed had Fox as its network big brother to go to for sort of the four prime time races in the middle of the season, if you will. I think we'll see the same with NBC, but we don't know. It's a bit of an unknown quantity, but this does mean, we say goodbye to Speed TV for their coverage. And it's kind of a mixed bag, right? I mean, we've talked at length in terms of the way that Speed coverage is compared to Sky and BBC and other coverage we've been involved with. And, the fact that we have some conversation about how they were, partway into this race, especially with a race like today, where, a 4-minute block of advertisements in the middle of the race can really, you can miss a lot. And then you're trying to catch up to that. And then there's new stuff happening and trying to do replays. I mean, it's a lot to work around. It would be great if you could watch it straight through live. But that's not really Speed Channel's fault as much as it is just the American TV system and the way the systems are set up that, yes, we pay for cable, but you still have advertisements on that paid thing that you get. It's just kind of the way that it is. So I don't think NBC is going to be able to do anything drastically differently.
No.
Every once in a while, you'll see sort of one corporate sponsor will present something, presented with limited commercial interruption by Ford or whatever. And there'll be kind of like little Ford graphics and there'll be a lot of like one long Ford commercial in the middle or something,
right,
rather than lots of little ones. So it's possible we'd see something like that. But I'd be very surprised if what we get out of NBC is drastically different in some of those fundamental ways. But at the same time, it has been, Speed Channel has been the outlet for Formula One in the U.S. And, we think for the budget that they've got and, kind of the task that they've been given, that these guys really do a commendable job.
Yeah, they did solid work considering the limited funds and limited access they were given.
Right.
But it also stems from... This makes sense because Speed as a network isn't going to exist anymore. It's going to become Fox Sports, as I understand it. And it's not just going to be about racing anymore. They're going to cover things like soccer and baseball and things like that as well. So, Speed as it is known to us is also changing. So if it were to stay with Formula One in the future, it might have made less sense in the first place. But I'm a little bit disappointed. I kind of feel like...
Well, NBC Sports isn't a motorsport network either, so I don't know that...
It's true.
There's much of a difference there.
It's true. But Speed, having been a motorsports network and is going away from that, is which way is it trending is my point. And I think it's a little bit of a lost opportunity. I fully respect David Hobbs and Steve Matchett, but at the same time, I feel like if you're going to make a clean break to a new network, that maybe it's not the best idea to carry over, effectively in my mind, if it is indeed Lee Diffy, 3/4 of the broadcast team that people are already used to.
Yeah, and I guess we should say we don't yet know where there may not be a contract there yet or whatever for Will Buxton, the pit lane reporter. There's been various rumors going around that maybe he'll be a new guy replacing Jake Humphrey at BBC. Maybe he'll move to NBC. I don't know what his contract is. I think he's freelance, whatever. But so we don't know. It could actually be three quarters of the team. You know, everybody but Bob Varsha basically moving to NBC.
And again, you know, we are familiar with Lee Diffie covering Formula One for Speed. So
yeah, it's happened times when Bob Varsha gets called to something else, usually car auctions, which is kind of lame in my opinion, but whatever. You know, Speed's his employer, they can do what they want with him. But yeah, I mean, that would be interesting if it were a new group of voices. I mean, you know, when you look at BBC coverage and it's how many more recent drivers do they have involved? I mean, with David Coulthard and Martin Brundle and these guys, you know, and Eddie Jordan is team guy and he's kind of a screwball anyway, but you know, but it's, you know, recent F1 experience and these guys sort of still have connections in the current F1 field. And especially, I mean, Coulthard, if you look at his resume and what he continues to do. I mean, he's still works for Red Bull, still does demo runs for them and stuff. I mean, when you look at how long has it been since one of these guys has been in an F1 car, and it's, you know, in the case of Coulthard, it's usually a matter of days.
Weeks at the most, yeah.
When was Hobbs last in a Grand Prix car, and how similar...
You can measure that in decades.
Yeah, and how similar was that to today's thing? So, yes, he knows, you know, he is a Formula One driver and drove for Formula One, but Formula One is so different now, and the cars are so different now and all that, so... You know, it's a balance there, but he's a known quantity for broadcasting, and there's certainly, you know, those out there that are just fans of the guy, as David Hobbs is sort of the character that he is.
Yeah, and I mean, and we also respect that talent, and we also respect Steve's Matchett's knowledge and what he's able to bring. But does that really, again, compare with the BBC level of quality? And then maybe that's not entirely fair. BBC being, you know, world class in this sense, and also, you know, England being the home to half the Formula One teams and being a much bigger sport there. But then the other side of things, some of what Speed does was, and they seem to actually back away from it some, but it was really just cheesy. Like, neither Jim or I were ever really a fan of these little poems that Sam Posey put together to tie into the pre-race shows and stuff like that. And some of their little, like, 60-second metal compilations of like different crashes and, you know, the quick editing, you know, flash type of thing. It's just like, it came off as just a little bit amateur, I guess.
Yeah, and I wonder what flavor NBC will bring to that, because it could be worse for all we know.
It could be, you know? Absolutely.
So I'm trying to stay optimistic about that. And if only for, you know, or I guess at the very least, the stuff that we do know is that we'll have some more sort of streaming access and things like that, which I think is only a good thing.
Right.
And we have some of that right now with ESPN. Like, I was able to watch, you know, 12 Hours of Sebring, and I think actually Petit Le Mans as well.
Well, what about, I thought we watched the actual 24 Hours of Le Mans. Wasn't that through?
No, that was Speed.
That was Speed.
And they had some sort of broken up coverage where they kind of take a break for a couple hours and come back and whatever.
But I thought they were streaming online
time. Yeah, they went to streaming when it wasn't on TV, but they offered one
at
a time.
Okay.
So, but with ESPN, the way they do it right now with like Petit Le Mans, for example, as a 10-hour race, is that the whole thing is available completely live online on your phone or on your computer or whatever. You have to have ESPN through your home cable package, but we all do, and you could watch the whole thing live. And then for the people, sort of the more casual viewers, then they had, and I guess once it's played live, you can watch it on demand for weeks following. I think I could actually still probably right now, if I wanted to, go back and watch the, you know, Petit Le Mans right now on my computer if I wanted to. But then they had like a 2-hour sort of synopsis that they played on ABC. So it was more prime time Sunday, when the course of the race actually happened on Saturday. They kind of edited it down into a compilation of, you know, 2 hours of sort of good moments of the race. And that, I think, is just fine. I mean, I guess because the hardcore people want it live, they want the whole thing. We got that. And the fact that it's on the phone, on the computer, gives me all the kinds of flexibility in terms of how I watch it, where I watch it. And then it still kind of gets that broad audience, you know, the excitement of people that aren't probably going to sit through 10 hours of it, but, you know, to sort of come across people's radar because it's on a major network. And if there are hours of rain delays or whatever, that stuff can all be edited out. So it's all kind of down to a synopsis of coverage on TV. Like, that kind of balance, I think, works really well. And that's just for something that's even, you know, way lower in terms of, you know, profile in marketability and everything than F1. So if that's how, you know, that's ESPN, that's a different network. But something like that, I'm hopeful based on the technology side of it that we can get something good. And, you know, those of us like you and I that want to be able to follow stuff live and want to be, you know, wherever I am to get that should be good. But we don't know yet. And we're just going to be hopeful.
Right. And the one more piece of advice I will give NBC Sports, if they are listening, is to try to play a, try to cater just a little bit higher than the guy that's never watched F1 before. Try to just not always assume that people watching a broadcast is the first time. To mention what KERS is or how the qualifying works on occasion makes perfect sense. But we were constantly spoon-fed the lowest common denominator of F1 knowledge at speed, and I think that grew tiresome as well. And I think you can help bring your fan base up a little bit by giving them a little bit more of the advanced level talking and let the new people kind of learn about it, as opposed to always trying to speak to people that may never have seen the sport before.
You see those black round things on the corners? Those are the tires, ladies and gentlemen. Notice there's not a car around the tires. These are called open wheels.
Exactly.
I mean, because you get that, you know, I am not a close follower of really any sports but motorsports. So, you know, if I were to watch, you know, like I get football, like American football at a basic enough level of kind of there's downs and there's lines of scrimmage and there's
right,
like
right.
kind of.
You know why they're happy when they got to the end of the field.
I think so. Yeah. but if I'm watching, they're not constantly explaining the rules to me.
Right.
But I can still enjoy a game with people and people that are getting excited about it and all that. I don't feel like I'm so confused right now. I wish the announcer would tell me something, because if I'm watching, I'm probably watching with people that are more interested in it than I am, or maybe I've flipped channels and stumbled across it, in which case they're probably the odds of them just grabbing my attention with explaining something to me at that moment are so small anyway,
right,
that they're not constantly explaining the rules of the game. If I'm interested in it, I can talk to the people around me. I can look around, I can Google it.
It's so easy
and
to
read
learn.
A Wikipedia
yeah.
article all about it and learn all the ins and outs just as exactly as much as I want. And it sort of challenges me to do so by not explaining it. So if I were to watch a sport that I'm less familiar with, and go say, okay, like I'm going to watch a cricket match, I don't know all the ins and outs of it, and you know, I guess I don't expect them to explain it to me. I kind of want partly the challenge of just I'm going to watch it and see what I can gather from it, and sort of what are the rules here and why can't this guy just go do this that way? But I can, you know, it's almost more interesting that way when you seek it out yourself a little bit. And then you don't, you know, risk alienating the rest of us when you could be saying something really interesting and insightful.
Exactly.
Then you're just sort
of... Some of the more nuanced commentary that you and I are looking for.
Right.
Yeah, more balance from there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, there's two different colors on the side of his tire. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Oh, my God. And you know that it's by mandate that they have to change, have used both compounds, blah, blah, blah. It's like, yes, we know. We're told every time. So there's some opportunities for improvement there. But all in all, like Jim mentioned earlier, We appreciated the coverage we got, and I guess this is a good moment to say a official thank you to Bob Varsha, and I think he did a commendable job for the most part based on, you know, the resources he had and the people he worked with. I think he did a solid job, and I'll miss him calling the races.
Yeah, and he seems cool peeps. He's on Twitter fairly regularly, and he'll just kind of get into a talkative mood where I can imagine he just sort of sits down with a cup of coffee or a glass of whatever and just goes, all right, I'm going for it. He'll have like 20 tweets in a row just responding to fans with all
right,
manner
we,
of questions.
We saw that on our way back from Texas. You were reading those off
yeah,
to me as I was driving.
Some
yeah.
are like really insightful, interesting questions, and some are really dumb. But he sort of replies to all of them, and so I appreciate that kind of – we can sort of see him as the real person that he is, and you know, his opinions on stuff. And then half the questions were about F1, and half were about sort of the coverage and speed and whatever. And people were asking about, oh, how's the race going to be covered and blah blah blah, like asking Bob Varsha, the guy who's not going to work for NBC Sports, like how's it going to work on the race weekends. And he's like, I'm not the guy to ask for that.
Right,
but you know,
exactly.
The fact that he's just willing to engage with people and all that, I think it's very cool. Will Buxton has been cool and about tweeting about what's going on and all that. And Steve Matchett is a pretty interesting guy to follow as well. He's kind of got a sort of screwball angle on a couple of different things that's sort of interesting. David Hobbs, I think, is slightly old like you and is not really hit the Twitter.
I like how I'm comparing David Hobbs and all this.
I think you may be the David Hobbs
of
the F1 show. You're the David Hobbs of
Quite
Twitter.
Quite possibly, although I might argue that point a little bit. It's funny to hear, I'll say that much. By the way, the it's all good noodle salad thing was finally explained to us in Austin.
Yes.
Well, enough research was done to figure that out. And if you are unaware, it's a movie reference to As Good As It Gets with Jack Nicholson and Helen Hunt.
Yeah, that's Jack Nicholson's whole thing about – anyway, so that is a total random blast for the past that without context.
But that is the type of thing
– That's Steve Matchett.
That's Steve Matchett.
Doing his thing.
Exactly, and that's the kind of tweets you get and so on and so
yeah,
forth.
Yeah, twitter.com/Robin Warner. Most recent tweet was a reply to someone, and that was November 7th. 2010.
That was good.
Over 2 years ago.
Good important thing.
Dude's got 13 tweets and follows 7 people. So, you know.
Listen, to be fair, I have tweeted on and been twatted at as a representative of Fun with Cars Twitter account. Let's be fair. In fact, I remember tweeting...
You spelled Formula One wrong. Formula. So, anyway,
it's... I remember tweeting earlier today, thank you very much.
Yes.
Some insightful things, might I add.
Fair enough. But, anyway, I had to explain retweet to you this morning. And hashtags. We all learned about hashtags today.
Hashtags are hard. And they don't make any sense. Oh, you learned
new
right. thing.
We were talking about goodbyes, and Speed Channel was one. And another is Michael Schumacher. We haven't really mentioned a whole lot, but he's retiring again.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's one of those things. He shouldn't have retired at the end of 2006. I think that's become quite clear. And it's really a shame that this last season went the way it did. I think, and I've said this throughout the year, he definitely made some bonehead moves, but he's also had some miserable luck in that Mercedes. But, you know, his role there was to really help, you know, one of the things he's so famous for at Ferrari is just building a monster team around him and turning it into the powerhouse that it was in the early 2000s. And that was his job to do again at Mercedes. And I don't know how much of that is his fault and how much of that is Ross Braun's. I mean, Ross Braun's ultimately the team principal, but he just wasn't able to do it like he was at Ferrari. So I guess that's the overall major disappointment. But I feel like had he had better luck in 2013, he might have been interested in staying because he definitely had some flashes of that old brilliance. I mean, the pole at Monaco before he had this 5-grid spot penalty is just a perfect example of that. He was on the podium. I forget where. Was that Hockenheim that he ended up on the podium? I forget where that was. I mean, he had some you know, really good drives. And then today, to go on to finish 7th in a car that clearly isn't that competitive anymore in diabolical conditions, it's not like he's slow. But 3 years out of the sport, probably lost the absolute edge he had when he left in 2006. And, you know, I just don't think he could deal with being in a mid-pack car.
And I think the challenge of building a team around you and doing what he did with Ferrari is very different based on where you are in your career and what you've proven already.
True.
I mean, you know, how hungry is he, you know, in terms of the age and the energy is one thing, but in the physical fitness, which it seems like he was right up there with the best of them, but just mentally, when you think about, you know, as a younger driver trying to establish yourself and you know, getting these little opportunities and you know, improving little places where you can and building this team up and all that, it must just be a very different outlook than coming in after 3 years out of it, being, you know, a very, very rich, you know, wealthy guy,
yeah,
having already proven yourself, already being at the top of all these different record books. It's just, it has to be a different mental game.
Right, right.
And
it's unavoidable.
And you know, as much as you know, maybe, oh, this will be kind of fun, and, you know, hey, I'm teaming up with Ross Braun again. This is going to be great. It's going to be like the good old days, and, you know, we'll be able to make some stuff happen. It'll be cool. And then it's obviously was harder than that, and there's more to it than that. And then, yeah, just all these retirements and all these mechanical problems and various things, you know, certainly didn't help the whole deal. But I am glad to see that it was a points finish, if not better, for Schumacher at the end. It wasn't another mechanical retirement to you know, fizzle out the end of his career, or, you know, even a 12th place finish or whatever, like,
or some random accident.
Yeah, some,
definitely,
or,
thankful,
yeah,
for
crashing
that
into an SGR or something.
Right.
So yeah, it was at least you know, a solid finish, we can say. I mean, a points finish, you know, not worse than that.
Given the performance of that car, I think we can reasonably call it a solid finish. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's at least it's you know, going out on that note. And there was a lot of, you know, kind of thank you, Michael, and, you know, farewell kind of messages from various other teams and drivers and things around the paddock. And, you know, it was sort of cool to see. And then Rubens Barrichello was in the pit lane this week as a reporter for some Brazilian news station as well. So you kind of had these moments of, you know, Schumacher and Barrichello and all the stuff. And you sort of this, like, you know, it transcends the day-to-day team rivalries and stuff a little bit, where it's like, you know, this is kind of something special here. You know, this guy Schumacher, really, you know, kind of an amazing deal. Vettel is obviously becoming the new, you know, crazy, amazing record setter and all that. And just sort of like, this is, you know, there is some pretty special stuff happening here. It sort of, I think, can take away from some of the cynicism and all the nonsense.
Absolutely.
That goes along.
And that's what we want to avoid here today and place some proper respect to the man that still is the legend and now can continue to be that legend without these little, you know, pockmarks of his current results and what happened. He's like, he is the legend that slammed into the back of Sergio Perez and, you know, whatever happens, you know.
Yeah.
It's just those type of things not happening anymore is just all for the best. And I think at this point he can at least say, all right, I don't have some massive hunger to come back into this sport. You know,
yeah.
Is he going to have regrets or wish that things went differently? Sure. But he's run well over 300 Grand Prix now, spanning 20 years. I mean, just that's good.
Kick back, dude. Relax. Enjoy it. You know,
go fishing. Come up with your own brand of salmon.
I mean,
we got that vodka thing with Jay-Z we talked about earlier.
He bought a ranch in Texas, you know, when he was there, apparently. So maybe he'll go herd cattle and ride around his Harley and just kind of be a crazy old German guy
much
in the middle
like
of Texas.
You and I decide on a whiff to go get a candy bar at a convenience store. Yeah, 500 acres.
Whatever.
Why not?
And then one other note, while we're talking about Schumacher and by extension Mercedes, and by extension from there, Lewis Hamilton going to Mercedes, you know, while we're on that subject.
Yeah, okay, sure.
Which we're now on. I heard an interesting bit about Hamilton's move to Mercedes, and that was that, and of course, you know, the whole story has been up until this, you know, the Mercedes hasn't scored any points since that was announced, and is that really a move forward, or is it sideways, or is it back, or whatever. But that come 2014, we'll have the whole new engine formula, right? The twin turbo V6s, or at least turbo V6s, and more Kurs, and blah, blah, blah. And the theory was that the manufacturers, Mercedes, instead of McLaren, the customer car for the Mercedes teams, will be better integrated. Sort of will have possibly a better implementation of a brand new engine formula like that than like that the manufacturer would have a better implementation than the customer cars. That it may be the case that, you know, for next year it's probably, you know, sort of is what it is, but you know, that'll be Lewis Hamilton finding his way and, you know, seeing what's what with the car and figuring out the team and all that. But that when 2014 comes along, they will have you know, potentially more testing miles, and that they can sort of maybe build the engine with characteristics they want more in mind or whatever, that he'll be, you know, Hamilton will be closer to the source of that engine, and that may be, you know, that the Mercedes may be better off than the cars that they sell those powertrains to.
Interesting.
Do you think there's any merit to that?
That's possible. It's possible. And I also think that, you know, Lewis is saying what he's saying to help manage expectations. But, I mean, frankly, I wouldn't be surprised if Lewis puts in some Alonso-like performances when compared to the capability
of the
Hamilton
car. Alonzo's it.
That's what I'm saying.
Well, I mean, yeah, there's, I guess, no reason to think that Vettel won't keep Vettling it. But, yeah, we'll see if Hamilton can start Alonso in races and doing that. And, of course, there's other moves, like Charles Speke moving from Marussia to Caterham, which... You know, those two, as we just talked about, there's not much between them. And as you know, as it happened, Caterham edged them out. But will they continue on a trajectory forward, or will they still battle out?
It's
not necessarily a step forward. And then we had Hülkenberg, right?
Yeah.
Going to Sauber from Force India.
Yeah.
After leading the race in a Force India, and look where the Saubers were, and you know, the scoring. Like, there's a lot of these sort of
right.
What who's going to be where? And of course, those are both. Those are all customer teams we just mentioned. There's not like a, you know, move to the manufacturer. But, you know, when it is an interesting phenomenon where Mercedes, as the manufacturer, has been so outclassed by their customer car and McLaren that it's, you know, it's a little bit different than, of course, you know, Ferrari versus,
right.
You know, the other cars running Ferraris.
And that'll be interesting to see where that all that stuff falls. But I have to say, you mentioned Nico Hülkenberg. It reminded me of something I wanted to say, which I'm not sure you're going to like or agree with. Maybe will, though. I honestly think McLaren, looking at Nico Hülkenberg's performance, I think Nico should have gotten that McLaren seat, to be totally honest with you.
Checo Perez!
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's kind of what I was thinking. But, I mean, and, you know, maybe it's just luck, and maybe it's just the car and everything else. But if you look at Nico Hülkenberg's last five races versus Sergio's, it's kind of amazing. I mean, Nico has gone well clear of Paul di Resta these last few races.
Yeah.
And, frankly, personally, I think Hülkenberg would have been a better McLaren driver, but we don't know.
Yeah,
could be totally wrong.
Yeah, I can't say I disagree with that. Of course, you know, there's nothing we can you know, we can speculate all that we like. Really, you know, I guess I'm sort of hopeful for Checo and in McLaren. Hopefully, that will turn well. Partly, I guess, just because of that Mexican connection, and if that moves all the you know, rumored and sort of talked about maybe agreed to Mexican Grand Prix stuff forward. As we haven't mentioned yet, but I will now, Esteban Gutierrez, the other Mexican driver in F1, has now been signed to Sauber. So he is now, you know, the Telmex sponsorship and stuff all kind of make sense again. And that is, you know, there's now two Mexicans in F1, which is a very big deal for that country and should be very good for, you know, chances of a Mexican Grand Prix and the money and sponsors all finding the right ways. But yeah, as far as, a you know, just as getting results out of the car, Hulkenberg seems like, yeah, would be a good fit at McLaren. And I, you know, who knows, right?
Right.
But I'm still hopeful that the Checo will do well, and I'm hopeful that Hulkenberg will do well too. But yeah, it'll be fun. We got plenty to think about in the off season, and plenty to look forward to in 2013 and beyond.
Yeah, but I think we are ready to hand off to you guys and get to some listener feedback with one final super quick goodbye, and this, we hope, is a goodbye and a happy one. Stepped noses. You have that written down, and I agree with you. It's nice to say fare thee well.
Yes, as they talked about, the FIA will allow teams, or I think mandate teams, to run a, you know, cover piece, basically, that just makes that a smooth step instead of an ugly, awkward step. In some cases, uglier and more awkward than others. So I was just noticing that on some of the cars today as going around these corners and these side shots, especially something like the Mercedes, where it's kind of this weird round platypus bill and then goes to a kind of a squared off. It's just there's some awkward angles on these cars, and it will be nice once this one-year weirdness of these you know, step noses, once that's gone and we have at least smooth noses on the car, and then we'll see where it all goes from there. But so, you know, that was ugly while it lasted, and hopefully that's now gone forever.
Agreed.
And we can have back to begin having cars that we're watching actually be kind of cars that we like to look at. That will be a nice return to form.
Easier on the eyes.
Yeah. So, listener feedback.
Right, and we actually have quite a bit of listener feedback to go through, as we weren't able to give it much attention when we were traveling 80 miles an hour up I-35 in Texas. Wait, what's the speed limit there? 75 miles an hour.
In some places, 80. In some places, 85, but hey.
But hey, that's how
Texas is pretty good on speed limits.
Law-abiding. Anyway, we got an email earlier in November from Nia Moon, who says, "Guys, as much as conspiracy theories seem adverse to business and common sense, there have been examples of both common sense and business sense failing in F1. That said, I present to you the more plausible conspiracy theory. McLaren has to have Button place higher than Hamilton so that Lewis's departure doesn't seem as bad when Martin Whitmarsh does his presentation to McLaren's board of directors, the added bonus of making Lewis look deficient. However, conspiracy or not, car failures make McLaren look worse. Regards, Nia." So it's an interesting theory. I still don't think Jim and I are quite on board with that. It's in McLaren's best interest to get as high in the Constructors' Championship and as high in the Drivers' Championship as possible every year. And supporting Lewis as best they can is going to be the best way to do that, as opposed to, you know, purposefully keeping Lewis from being able to score as well as Jensen.
Yeah, there's got to be some really deliberate short-term payoff, in my opinion, for it ever to be worth it to intentionally give yourself a bad result. And that, like the Singapore Renault deal from 08, I think it was, where it was like, okay, we know if Nelson Piquet Jr. crashes and we get the safety car, then we know that we'll get this immediate short-term payoff. But the kind of long-term, to sort of like, let's start hampering his season early, because you know, if we've seen anything from the last few years of F1, is you just don't know what's going to happen. You just cannot, you know, what it looks like halfway through the season may or may not have any bearing on the way the season actually finishes up. So there's, yeah, I don't think that they would be in a position where they don't want to get it as high as possible for both drivers and as high as possible in Constructors' Championship for all the money that's involved there, and then, you know, having the numbers on their cars for the following year and all these different things. And it does raise the point, though. We actually didn't really run down the Drivers' Championship standings for the season end. But as it happens, Hamilton is above Button by 2 points, even with his retirement out of today's race.
Right.
It wouldn't really make sense to
I mean, it was
slow
actually
Hamilton down by more.
It was a much bigger gap than that, but Jensen capitalized on this race, and Hamilton ended up not scoring.
Yeah,
so
I don't think that was McLaren's design. But Sebastian Vettel, of course, at the top, Alonso in second place, and there was the only one in contention at the end there. And then 71 points behind him is Kimi Raikkonen, who did get third spot. Hamilton, Button, and then Webber. And then a pretty big drop off back to Massa, and then another pretty big jump to sort of the rest of the field. Romain Grosjean, Nico Rosberg, Checo Perez, Nico Hülkenberg, Kobayashi is in 12th. Schumacher, DiResta, Maldonado, who even with his one win is still only 15th in the championship, but ahead of Bruno Senna by a considerable margin. Jean-Eric Vergne, Daniel Ricciardo, and then all the guys that scored no points, but in terms of order of finishes and all that.
Right.
Petrov is the best of the bottom in terms of in 19th place. Timo Glock, Charles Pic, Heikki Kovalainen, Jerome D'Ambrosio with his one drive with Lotus after Grosjean's suspension. And then Naren Kartikeyan and Pedro de la Rosa is very last spot. So it's actually a less weird season than usual with only one reserve driver called in, and that being Jerome D'Ambrosio. Usually there's a little bit more switching around and various different things that happen over the course of the year. So in that regard, it's actually fairly simple with only 25 drivers competing this year.
Right. And getting back to the other side of that question, Nia, is that McLaren also pushed very hard to retain Lewis Hamilton. They offered him tons of money. They matched as best as they understood Mercedes' offer and tried to do everything it can to retain Lewis. So there really isn't much that Martin Whitmarsh has to say to the board of directors other than I tried as hard as I could to keep him. So there is zero, I think, benefit for him to go to them and say, see, he's not that good anyway, because it was already made clear that he's a very, very valuable driver and we should throw as much at him as they can to keep him.
Yes, and in related news, we also got an article forwarded to us by Robin Tom, who says, an interesting article about F1 driver salaries, and I've tracked down the article, and this is for 2012, it breaks down who makes what, from Fernando Alonso at the top of the heap with 30 million euro salary per year, who's almost double the next guys, which are the McLaren drivers, Hamilton and Button, who are both on par, making 16 million euros a year. And ahead of Vettel and Weber, who are also at par, and also with Massa and Rosberg, all of them making 10 million euros a year. And then it kind of goes on down from there. But a couple of little interesting nuggets. And, of course, this doesn't include external endorsements and things like that. So there are certainly going to be swings where Vettel, on the whole, and point bonuses and all that, where Vettel will make a lot more money than Mark Weber.
Yeah. Also even though their salaries are the same. Ferrari FFs given to Fernando Alonso for winning races, for example.
Or SLSs or whatever.
Or whatever.
So Schumacher makes less than Nico Rosberg by 2 million euros. Some of these guys down near the bottom, I mean, if you look at like Nico Hülkenberg at 500,000 euros, $500,000 when you look at, he passed the €16 million a year guys.
Right.
When you sort of look at value for money and what you're getting out of a driver, it's funny how that market changes as you get good, and then you get good enough that you can, gain such a good salary from the team that you're so much more of a marketing entity. It's not just how fast can you get this car around the track, because it's not that Alonso is twice as fast on track or three times faster than Sebastian Vettel on track, obviously, because that would be amazing. But it's just kind of how the whole dynamics of it go. And then it's down to Charles Pic in last place, 24th, with 150,000 euros a year salary, which is not a bad salary as a race car driver anyway.
It is not.
Let alone many other industries.
But it's not the jet-setting lifestyle.
Maybe. I mean, he's on jets a lot. He goes all over the world and drives race cars and probably has some sponsor deals, sponsors. And
right, but I doubt he owns his own jet. And
that's where the jet set comes in?
That's where the jet set comes in.
So,
And it's also interesting to think about what your point that you brought up about Nico Hülkenberg is an excellent one, because I remember when Lewis Hamilton's first contract came out in 2007, it was worth like $370,000 or something like that, which is a lot of money. If I were to come home and tell my wife I'm now earning $370,000, she would be extraordinarily happy with me. But in Formula One terms, that was a pretty low salary. And then obviously that quickly changed after he almost won the championship his rookie year.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It'd be interesting to see what Nico's salary is next year.
And like Timo Glock, for example, Charles Peake's teammate, makes 3 million euros a year. So that's the difference in terms of,
from
150 grand to 3 million in terms of, paying a guy for the experience and what other options he may have had and what they needed to do to get that kind of experience. And you look, Kovalainen for Caterham, 4 million euros a year. That's four times more than Kobayashi, and Romain Grosjean, who get a million euros a year each. Chico Perez, only half a million. So anyway, kind of interesting breakdown.
Absolutely.
And it's a way of it is exactly, the teams.
And is that a reliable source, what we're reading off of?
Something, I don't know if it's published by FIA, but some company that publishes these things. And, so the overall earnings, as we say, are going to be different. But as an interesting one part of the conversation is that. And kind of neat. So thanks for sharing that, Robin. And that was actually sent all almost like a month, like on the 6th of November, but we've had chaos in between then and now.
Nudging ever closer to the present, on the 7th of November, we got an email from John Matthew, who said, great show. I love the preview of the Austin track. The discussion about what it is like to sit in an F car was one I had never heard before. You talked about how you can change the differential with paddles on the back of the steering wheel. On your next show, can you explain, please explain what that means? And then he said, in general, you might want to consider an education segment on your show, not F1 at 101, what the flags mean, for example, but something more advanced. I doubt I'm the only listener who does not know what a differential is.
Right, and that was the one where we did talk about his differential.
Right,
and,
exactly. So he went on to say, thanks for responding to my email. You did help explain what a differential is, and I did go to Google and find this video. So yeah, that original email was on the 30th of October. He thanked us and he found this Google, this little YouTube video, which I guess we should put the link on Facebook or something. He said it is from Chevy from the 1930s, but it explains almost as well as we did. So there you go. And it goes to show that ultimately these things, the bones, the fundamentals of these things haven't changed in quite a while now. And then on to, I'm gonna say this wrong, Massimo Tatone, I think it is.
I'm going to go with Massimo, but also so John is from Toronto, and Massimo is from Mississauga, right, a suburb of Toronto, so a bunch of Canadians that are digging. Just also says, yeah, thanks for the update, and does say that we did more to help understanding than to confuse them, so we appreciate
we'll take
that, because it was sort of sketchy for a minute there. We had also some feedback from a way back on the page itself. On funwithcars.com, I should mention, on the Abu Dhabi show, where Pablo Gomez asked if we were available on Stitcher Radio, which at the time we were not, but now we are. So anyone who uses Stitcher, it's a sort of a cool radio service for subscribing to multiple podcasts and different sort of audio sources and putting it all together. And it's actually being built into more and more cars. I think like the Volt, GM Volt, for example, or Chevy Volt, has like Stitcher Radio built in through cellular network and some various things. So now you can find the Fun with Cars Grand Prix show on Stitcher. And if you have any other friends that you think may enjoy our show, we always appreciate you sending along a reference, and that's one more place you can find us, and we appreciate it if you do. So thanks, Pablo, for giving me the heads up on that, and now we are part of that system.
And getting much closer to the recent past, Scott Cooper sent us an email as well saying, hi, guys, just got back from Austin. Awesome. My brother-in-law turned me on to your podcast, and I really enjoy the laid-back way you guys talk about F1. I was hoping you could give a little more insight into the KERS system. He went on to discuss a little bit about his past. So it seems like we are developing, getting a little bit of consistent interest in us explaining some things. And we like the idea of explaining KERS as well. We're not going to do it right now, but we're actually going to try to explain it possibly visually. If we can.
I think we can explain it right now. This show is not long enough yet. To understand KERS, you first must understand electricity. No.
we can give a brief 30-second summary if you'd like. And effectively, what it is like a car has a lot of energy, especially when it's moving really fast. And brakes on a car are used to transfer that energy from movement to heat. And that's basically what brakes do. And
Wow, you're really going for it, aren't you?
Yeah. And what KERS does... What KERS does is basically use the energy of the car to spin a generator. So as the car's slowing down, it's not just producing heat. It's spinning a generator, which creates electricity. That electricity is then stored in a battery. And then that same generator is then used as an electric motor to help propel the car at a later time. So effectively what the KERS system is a way to capture the energy from braking, store it for a little while, and then use it to help propel the vehicle at a different stage on the track. And the potential of KERS is very limited by the regulations, but that's going to open up a lot in 2014. And we're also going to try to do a more advanced and maybe even clearer explanation of it in the near future.
So there you go.
There you go.
So there's a couple of the messages in here. We'll just hit. So Paul Perry sent us the link to the T-shirts that Kimi Räikkönen, and he gave that those T-shirts to everyone in the Lotus team, the whole leave me alone, I know what I'm doing, which is funny. I mean, that struck, I think, me and I think both of us as a little bit of a kind of a weird thing to give your team. It's one thing. It's sort of, if it's just a funny quote, like the ice cream and a Coke or whatever, when, you know, Lotus Hospitality sort of sends all the journalists an ice cream and a Coke when it's a rained out session or whatever. That's just all in fun. There's no one really there. But Kimi was being kind of a dick to the guys on the team. He sent us that link and thanks for the heads up on that. And also another shout out to Gary M, who, gave us some feedback from a little while ago. Again, thanks us for the differential discussion and also just made the point that, of course, different turn radiuses, you're going to have to change what your diff is doing from 150 mile an hour sweeper to a first gear 40 mile an hour hairpin, and having different diff settings to get the power down just makes a lot of sense kind of once you start thinking it through. And he was figuring all those times we saw on-car shots where the drivers were messing with things on their steering wheel that they were just getting bored and trying to find stuff to do. But actually, you know, between that and the brake bias that they actually have a lot to do. So.
And I want to jump back to Scott Hooper because he explains more specifically what he's looking for in the KERS question from us. Like I said, we'll get to that later. But he also ends by saying, here's a shout out to all the general admission crowd at Turn 11. Thanks for making the 3 days a great experience. Not that I am against the wine and cheese crowd in the corporate suites, but the average working person seemed to show up in force, and we met some really nice people over the 3 days. So I want to make sure to get that part of his email read as well, because that's nice.
Yes, and then more recently we had feedback from USGP on there. A shady character named CKW comments on the show.
Oh, dear.
We disappointed him. He says, I'm disappointed. Where were the driver interviews? And he has that with an exclamation point, not a question mark. So I guess it's just, where were the driver interviews? That's a statement.
And the answer is that it was a statement and that we don't know?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what driver interview he's talking about. Then he goes, question, did you manage to watch the world feed of the race? What did you think of it? For me, it was awful. And I remember him mentioning about that during the race, but I watched it in replay on speed on my TiVo, a couple days ago, which was kind of nice, to ease into the Brazil weekend. It was Thanksgiving holiday, of course, yep. And all that, and plenty of time off. So I did watch the race, and it was an enjoyable race to watch. It was very good, and I think Brazil will be one I'll be rewatching again as well, just to kind of soak that in. But it didn't strike me as bad. So I wasn't watching it with an eye towards like let's watch for the mistakes. But he says, cutting from one set of racing into a corner, then cuts to another set of racing coming out of a corner, terrible long shots up the main straight. Cutting to one guy doing a pit stop when Hamilton is close to Vettel. Shots of the cars kept on screen too long, so you only see the rear wing over the brow of the hill, and that's just a few examples. So whoever was producing it needs shot. Get some Europeans in to show you how to do it properly. So first of all, I didn't notice that it was actively bad. I think, with a critical eye towards just about anything, you and especially I can pick apart any piece of media or anything and find problems with it. But it didn't strike me as bad. And I don't know that the problem was not enough Europeans. I mean, in their defense, Ron Howard and George Lucas and Matt LeBlanc and various other people that probably know a thing or two about, cameras and cars and kind of putting things on screen were there. So I don't think that it was the problem was not enough Europeans, but, it's possible that, the feed is basically the same. Then, of course, I think Speed is able to do their own replays and stuff on top of it. So I don't think that was vastly different, but he may have, I guess, watching it in person live, we were getting a different thing out of the replay than a normal watcher would be getting. So there may have been some difference there.
I will say, though, to that point that I did feel, and I don't know how much this is actual the raw feed so much as the editing. I guess it's the feed mostly. I did think that it was a little bit odd the way they cut to and from the fight for the lead between Lewis and Vettel and some of the other action on track. I thought some of that was a little bit on the harsh side, and there were definitely times where I wanted to see more of what was going on between Vettel and Hamilton, and I wasn't getting it. But I didn't, like you said, I didn't notice a stark contrast between the specific shots of this event versus many of the other events we have on the calendar. And I think part of the extremely long shots we were getting is that the U.S. track that we have now is one of the tracks with an extremely long straightaway. So that could be part of it. And also, it's also kind of a long and narrow track in general, because you're basically kind of driving out to one side with the turns 2 through 8 and all the way to 10, 11 out to the one straight. And then you have the big, long straightaway coming back. So it is kind of a long and narrow place, which does lend itself to bigger, longer shots in general, perhaps.
Yeah, although it would be cool if we had one of those cable cams or whatever. Like I think you get in Nürburgring or Hockenheim, a couple of those. I remember Germany, I think some other ones as well.
Oh, yeah, sure.
If
exactly
along turn
about.
One or along the front straight, as the car comes out of 20, if we could follow it along at full speed and sort of watch the car and then kind of come up the hill and then you'd see it disappear over turn one, like that would be cool. that's not the World Feed so much as just whatever money they put into it. But anyway, yeah, that may have been a bigger problem for you than it was for us, but may still be an issue. And then that, I think, wraps up the email and comments on the shows.
I believe so.
We could spend days going through the feedback we've had on Facebook. We've had just a lot of people interested in the live Austin coverage, the pseudo live coverage, the reports on the road trip and the whole thing. We posted the final thing. I think it was about over 2,900 miles for our little road trip.
2,908.8, if I am reading correctly.
And the whole thing. So just a massive thank you to everyone who sort of took part in that. It wasn't just us delivering to you, but the whole, that was a lot of our experience as well, was reading what people were writing there and kind of seeing what people liked and all that. It was a lot of fun for us. And then, again, watching the race live today, we had some, a good group of people, I think, over 50 comments on our various race threads and different things. So just big thank you to everyone taking part in that. Of course, CKW, Laurie Jordan, always representing in there from Canada. The Australians staying up super late to watch this.
Absolutely.
So Ziggy and Bainsey and the various other Aussies, Colin. So it's Percy, Ziggy, and Bainsey. I don't know what's going on over
there.
That is
kind of awesome.
But anyway, I guess the bottom line is when the races are on, especially if it's on one that we've either said we're going to do live or is on a time zone that makes sense for us, then, just fire up Facebook, fire up Twitter, probably Twitter more so than Facebook, because the comments get all out of order and screwball on Facebook, man. We didn't like the way they do that. I think once people start liking different comments, and then Facebook says, oh, this is more important, right? So you get stuff gets all out of order and it gets all kind of wonky. So Twitter does seem to be better for these real-time things, and you can mix our feed with what other people are saying, and kind of all works together. Funwithcars.com is the central hub for all of that. You can reply right on our shows right there. You can see links to our Facebook page. You can find our Twitter stream, all that kind of stuff there. And it's just massive thanks, as always, to everyone who's taking part in the show, because it's not just you and I, Robin. It's the whole listener crowd and everyone who's following us. It all just makes it part of the fun.
Agreed, yeah. And then it was a lot of fun to be able to share with many people, and you say something, and then someone says something back. You're like, whoa, I just said that. That's amazing. And I was blown away by the new and futuristic world that we live in.
Hashtags, man. Hashtags.
Now we have to deal with it. Predictions. Ugh.
All right, another enthusiastic toss from Robin there for predictions. I'm not feeling too bad about this myself. We did run through predictions on the USGP, so we've just got Brazil to run through. Am I right?
Yes.
What?
Yes. No, you're right. We did go through it, but we did not do it on the Excel spreadsheet that I have, but we did go through it effectively. So you are correct. We only have to go through Brazil. Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
So the other way to answer that question would have been yes. Okay.
I did say yes several times.
You did. So it is the end of the season, and so our prediction app has gotten us down to the end. We've got final results for everyone.
Yeah.
Both in what you and I did and all the other Facebook followers who have taken part. So I wanted first for Brazil, before we do the season wrap-up, big mention to Matt Pattison and Paul Schachman. Both predicted Hamilton Button for 0 points today, so...
Well done. Congratulations.
Well done, lads. And then we had a number of people with other various permutations getting a few points. I predicted Vettel for the pole position, and I was wrong, and Vettel for the win, and I was wrong, but I was only slightly wrong compared to you predicting Hamilton, where you were correct for pole position, but then way wrong for the race because you were tired, and how would you not know that? How would you not predict that Hulkenberg would smash into him?
And the whole thing, yeah. I mean, it was looking back at it, hindsight's 20/20, of
right.
course. It was pretty obvious.
So you had a 19-point day. I had an 8-point day, but our statistical model, Damien, who's, like an idiot, thought that Vettel, because he was on pole last time, would be again, and Hamilton, because he won last time, would win again, actually did worse than both of us. He got 22 points. So,
right.
Victory for Team Human, and I guess specifically for me in this one, particularly for out of the three of us. But like I say, Matt and Paul for 0 points.
Yeah, final stats. Jim, you won 11 individual races. Very well done to
Woo-hoo.
You. And scored a total of 179 points. I could only manage to win 8 individual races and score 210. Poor Damien, scored 283 points and was only able to win 4 of the races. Now, you may notice that adds to more than 20. There were definitely times where multiples were tied and we, you know, each get scored a victory at that point. So don't let that phase you. But anyway, it was a solid win for you, and my hat's off to you. You were able to predict better than me this year, and I congratulate you for it.
Just doing some math real quick. You owe me 31 Cokes.
That required math on your computer?
Yep.
Oh, dear. Yep. You've now lost many of those Cokes for having to do that on your computer.
What?
Sorry. That's the mental math.
It's hard
that's
to do
the mental math rule.
It's hard to do mental math and look this good at the same time, all right? But out of our Facebook followers, there are several of you that outperformed even me team fun with cars. Well, out of the three of us, then that was me, and then out of them there were six people that outperformed us handily. So massive shout out to Julie McKenzie with 157 points wins predictions for 2012.
I don't know how that sounds on the thing. I did it close to the microphone. I'm clapping. Congratulations.
Yes. Reese Milford, second place. Tony Drake, I think we can hold the applause till the end so that everyone's name can be heard. So rounding out the podium, Tony Drake. Then Neil Popham in fourth place. Louise Marks.
Well done, sir. Neil Popham, predictions captain himself.
That's right.
Prediction stud.
Ooh, prediction stud. That's the guy. Louise Marks in fifth. Jay Panesar is sixth. I came seventh. Then Darren Bowden and Cliff Cattell rounding out. No, Matt Pattison is 10th place. Then Bernard A., James Payne, and Stuart Mitchell. And then you, Robin, tied with Bodhi Tuladhar.
And 14th.
A number of other people. And then Damien ended up 24th. So I think Team Human wins this one by quite a bit over Team Spreadsheet.
Yes.
Because Damien, yeah, there were 23 people who predicted better than a spreadsheet.
One note here that we want to add. Luis Marks scored 169 points. Craig the Kilt Wilson scored 236.
Why are you trying to cause marital strife?
How many Cokes is that? I'm curious.
I don't know. I'm not even going to look at it because you're going to make fun of me.
I don't know if you want to trade Cokes for something else there. I'm just... Just mentioning that to whom it may concern.
Yeah, I think Sean Scanlon's going to be excited about that. He's been very eagerly posting things about victory dances and something about kilts, and it's gone weird over there.
Is that, I don't know if that's doing the dishes X number of times, or it's, cleaning up after something with the something. Just saying.
Just saying. Okay, so predictions. Australia 2013.
Oh, right.
Or World Championship 2013. Who do you like?
Who do I like? Well, I'll be honest with you. I think...
This is a long-winded way of saying button, isn't it?
Well, I actually was going to go that way a little bit. But it's tough to say, right? Because I actually really want to think that Ferrari is going to finally get their stuff together. Get their things together, as it were. And pull something out. So if you told me I had to guess right now.
You have to guess right now.
I don't know. Because go Vettel on this. I'm torn between Vettel and Alonso.
You could say Vettel-Alonso. That would be the mixed split. Because for qualifying, Alonso or, Red Bull being Red Bull. But who knows, right?
I'll tell you this. I'm going to say Alonso. I'm going to say Alonso on pole, Alonso to win the race for Australia 2013. Who's going to be world champion?
Even after the horribleness of Ferrari at the beginning of this year, and it was all later when it all came together for them, so that's interesting.
Here's what I'm going to say for constructors' champions, McLaren.
Ooh.
Drivers' champion.
We should write this down, by the way, before we forget.
No, we'll just forget.
Okay.
And then we can, it's plausible deniability.
Unless it's right, in which case we'll definitely write it down.
Then we'll definitely write it down. Driver's World Champion. Whew. No. Yeah.
Massa?
Jenson Button.
Ooh.
Yeah. I can't believe I just said that. All right. I'll write that down. Now it's your turn, buddy.
All right. For Melbourne, performance in the race, I'm actually going to go button. We're slightly different strategy here, based on the no knowledge that we have of 2013 cars or anything yet, but just seeing where we are now, and I guess Damien will go Hamilton button from carrying over from this year. For drivers championship, I'm going to go Fernando Alonso, and for constructors, Red Bull again. I think they'll have four in a row.
Wow.
Yep. I don't know. I don't mean to discount McLaren, but I think with the Button Checo combination may not be quite as fruitful as Vettel Weber overall. You know, just over the whole length of the season and everything that goes on. So and then Ferrari's, I don't know, Massa being Massa. I feel like the strongest pair of drivers is Vettel Weber, and that they will construct a fourth championship.
So you say Button.
Mm-hmm. For Australia.
And then you went on to say that Red Bull will be constructor.
Yep.
And that who's going to be driver?
Fernando Alonso. He's going to make that happen this year, next year.
Interesting.
In the future.
So we actually had a lot of overlap, just not in the same places. Like I mentioned Jenson Button and Alonso.
Like you're not John Eric Verne for championship.
Correct.
Year. Okay.
Correct. That's interesting. It also means essentially nothing because we may very well predict this again in a future show.
I don't think so. I think we should stick with this one because it's fun that way.
It is fun that way, but I'm just saying our memories might not serve to me.
That's what we have computers for. Oh, you needed a computer to write that down? You couldn't just remember that? I'm disappointed. You're losing cokes.
Dun, dun, dun. Okay, and who did I say? Button's going to win the championship?
Oh, so you can't even remember from 2 seconds ago.
I got it. I wrote it down. It's right there.
All right.
It's right there.
So so we had something like 37 people, I think, actively predicting on the Facebook page by the end of the year. And it would be really, really cool if next year we could get that up over 100. I think, you know, many people that found us midway through the season. And once you sort of had a big point deficit.
Well, and some people that started off with us and then missed a couple and then kind of fell off and said, I'm not going to win anyway anymore.
Right. So I think if anything, you know, this has been, you know, if you look at the midseason, Alonso had this huge gap, and obviously that ended up not coming back together for him and all that. So if anything, you know, it'd be great to see a lot of people start it and stick with it, and it's a lot of fun. We're going to see if we can come up with some kind of fun prize to get to the winners or the podium or whatever, as it were, for
yes.
The predictions people now. We were all loaded up with F1 show merchandise, but we all know what happened to that. That's
yes.
Not a thing anymore. So
right.
We're going to have to regroup a little bit and figure out what's going to happen there. But anyway, we're not promising any major cash prizes or anything, but it is a lot of fun to take part in, and it's really cool to see just kind of who, either based on logic or luck or just, you know, if you always go for the same guy or whatever, you know, whatever works for different people, to see how it all comes together over the course of a season. And it's just been a lot of fun. So massive thanks to Neil Popham for putting that whole app together on their Facebook page.
Yeah, it makes it way more fun to interact with this, yeah, and a lot of fun to follow. So that's a huge thanks to that.
And so I guess I can be happy on the top step of our Fun with Cars Grand Prix Show Predictions Podium.
Yay!
That at the beginning of the year had a whole different name to it. I guess that could be in our goodbyes column. Would be the F1 show season is dead and gone because now we're starting next season all Fun with Cars'd out, and hopefully we'll have some other new fun stuff going on in the next year as well.
That involve cars
and fun. Our two favorite
cars
things.
And things, yeah. And just a one step thanks everyone that listened to us through 2012. Jim and I had a blast doing it this year, despite our crazy schedules. We looking forward to do it next year and to be even more interesting, more cool, and have more fun stuff going on and more interactive. And also look for us in the off season. We certainly plan to continue to talk when we get a chance to sit down and talk, and you know, why not record it and share?
Arguably, some of our best stuff has happened in the off season and you know, mid season break and various things. So definitely keep in touch with us on funwithcars.com, Facebook, Twitter, all the other ancillary things that that go along with that.
Ooh, ancillary, like it. Nice,
yeah,
nice
that,
word
use. That was a good word, huh? And I had something else that I was going to say, but then you said the ancillary thing, and I got thrown off my game.
Did it involve making mayonnaise?
It's just that easy. What?
Just reminding you of one of my tangents. It's okay.
No,
which
certainly
on its own became another tangent because now I'm tangenting off as we speak.
This is not helping. Oh, it was going to be good too.
Oh,
I
come on.
I don't know what it is. It must not have been that good. All right. Anyway, keep in touch with us on all the various areas. Oh, yeah. Big shout out to those of you who have updated your podcast feed to funwithcars.com/podcast.
Ah.
Because right now, f1show.com/podcast still works, but it won't in the future. So between now and the next race, There will be some more changes there. So if you are on funwithcars.com all the way, then you are good. If you're in iTunes, you're all set. But if you use something other than iTunes, please, please, please make sure you continue to hear our lovely voices into the new year by making sure that your podcast feed is looking at funwithcars.com/podcast. If you have any questions on how to make that work or whatever, you know, email us. You should hashtag it. Or yeah, hashtag it.
As yes.
Is Robin's favorite
technology.
New skill. And we'll help make sure that that all works. But
you can Twitter your hashtag to
make
the
sure
fun with cars.
People don't get left behind.
And then their social medias.
I think it is time to end this show, ladies and gentlemen. And just so cool. That's it. No, man, that's the end of the year, man.
It's all come down to that, man.
Sebastian Vettel, 3-time World Drivers' Championship. Red Bull, 3-time in a row, Constructors' Champions.
And still that one proctologist finger, you know? I mean, really.
Yeah.
You need to come up with another finger, Sebastian.
And Alonso was just that look, man, after the race, of just that look of, it all was so close, and I tried and did all the things, and this is what happened, and Massa was crying, and it was a whole dramatic moment, and it's been pretty wild, and especially, I mean, this U.S. deal right near the end of the season, just to really kind of mix things up for us. And,
absolutely.
And our whole thing is, it's just been a lot of fun, and we thank everyone for coming along with us. So we'll be back at some point between now and March, but no guarantees on when. Keep up with us online in the meantime. Thank you so much for listening. I am Jim Lau.
And I'm Robin Warner. Thanks again for listening to us from the bottom of our hearts, and we'll see you later.